This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for listening. We hope you've enjoyed the last 11 episodes. One more to go. As you might be able to tell from some of the content, they were recorded pre-lockdown, pre this madness. But here we are. It's the end of May. We are speaking to each other from our own pads, not cell pads, but house, our own homes.
Neither Michael or I are in cells. We are still in our
You are still free. Rob, Mike, how are you getting on?
Go on, bruv.
Yeah, I'm good, thanks, Claire. I'm good. I'm in North London in my flat that I share with my girlfriend. About ready for lockdown to finish. I think probably like the rest of the world at the moment.
I'm all good, Claire. I'm just at my end in South London. Just been bored out my nut. But yeah, I'm surviving, I'm coping.
So rocking I'm well. Some kind of leather basketball vest by the looks of things, mate.
I knew he was going to say that. Hey, you know what he said? He said that this basketball jersey looks leather. That's mad, isn't
no
it?
No comment.
For the listeners, you obviously can't see it. It looks leather. Like a black leather basketball vest.
But it doesn't look leather.
Well.
I've got a big question for you, Boats. During all of this free time you've had in lockdown, have you listened to any of the episodes of your own podcast yet?
Yes.
That's a no.
No, Well, if I speak to people that have given me feedback, it's the same thing as me listening to it.
He's just outsourced it.
It's just. Exactly. Did you listen to your own episode last week?
Oh, 100% I didn't. No way. That would have made me vomit.
Well, we've had really great feedback. So thank you, everybody, who has listened and supported us and subscribed and rated and all of those official things we're meant to say. Keep sharing it.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Right. We've got two episodes left. We've got Rob's story today, which you're about to listen to. Hope you enjoy that one. And then the final episode next Monday is going to be reflections of the whole experience together. So we hope you enjoy those two. And we've decided we want to do a bonus episode and hear from you, our faithful audience. So if you've got any questions or comments, though preferably nice ones, let us know. We'd love to hear from you. Has anything that the guys have said reminded you of an experience you've had in custody or otherwise? Do you know anyone in prison? Have you got any other questions about things that they haven't touched on? You can get in contact with us by email. We've got an email address, which is bangeduppod@gmail.com, or Instagram, which is @bangeduppodcast. Full word, that one. So please do get in touch. We would love to hear from you, and we'll be recording an episode responding to what comes in. So just before we get on to Rob's story in a minute, an up-to-date question for you guys. Anything about lockdown experience that has reminded you of being inside, or any tips for us how to keep handling lockdown for those who haven't been through it before?
Does this remind me of lockdown? Yes, a little bit. It's quite similar. But then I think it's also in some ways really quite different. It's nice just being able to walk out the front door whenever you want, even if that is only for a little bit. Any tips? I would say try and stay as active and busy as possible. Other than that, no, I'm sure Boats is your man. He's probably got some top tips. Bike rides, Boats has got into cycling in the lockdown.
I've been cycling quite a bit. I started jogging, got bored of it, so I started cycling.
You're sounding very middle class here, mate. Jogging, exactly. Cycling.
Well, obviously, lockdown must turn a man into a middle class sort of man. But I've been cycling, exercising. I've just been trying to wear myself out, so I'm tired.
You sound like a toddler. That's why I do my toddler.
Exactly. Well, a middle class toddler.
That's it. The transformation is almost complete, mate. We've won you over.
Exactly.
And how do we keep going? Will we tick off the days? What do we do? Look ahead, don't look ahead. What's the advice?
I'd just say just take each day as it comes. We don't know what's going to happen. We don't know how long we're going to be in this world.
Do you know what? That's the hardest thing. I think at least when you got a prison sentence, they give you an end date.
Most people.
Now you're like, is it a month? Yeah. Is it 6 months? Who knows? So, I don't know. Yeah. Just take one day at a time. Any more cliches anyone can roll out?
Nothing. You said them all.
One day at a time.
Said them all.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's
give it 110%. Hang on, I sound like a footballer doing a post-match interview, and you sound like a middle-class bloke doing 60k bike rides, mate. What's happening here?
It's all mad.
Well, it's been great to see you two on Zoom, and hopefully we'll be reunited in a studio in the near future. But in the meantime, we'll say goodbye. Enjoy Rob's episode, and please do get in touch. It's bangeduppod@gmail.com or @bangeduppodcast on Instagram. Thanks very much. Bye, guys.
Thank you.
Cheers, bye, guys. Thank you.
I was very bored. I didn't like my job. I didn't see myself going anywhere in it. The lifestyle was getting better in that I was going to spend all my time with my mates. It looked like a chilled lifestyle. If I'm honest, it probably looked quite like exhilarating. You know, I was committing a crime. And that sounds fucking ridiculous. And when I look back now, that's like embarrassing.
Rob, you're up. It's your week.
What do you want to know?
We want to know why you got yourself into this mess.
Yeah, I've been asked that a few times. I asked myself it a few times.
Look at him settling down for his storytelling. Gather around.
I don't have a short answer for you.
Start with the short one.
Should we start explaining a bit about what I did, which we've not talked about?
Yeah.
So I was convicted of one count of conspiracy to defraud the mobile phone networks. I was approached by a good mate of mine from uni who explained to me that he had a business and like a loophole that allowed us to make money by paying people to take out phone contracts. I twigged pretty early on that there was something dodgy about that. I asked him and he did then explain, he sort of came clean and explained that actually there was all of it was based around like an illegal element. It was, defrauding the networks by using SIM cards and essentially stealing handsets. So at this point I was mid-20s, I was in 25 in a pretty cushy corporate job doing hospitality sales, but not earning a lot of money, you know.
And how did that conversation come about? Does it come about because you say to him, oh mate, you seem to be earning quite a lot of nice money, how are you doing that? Get me on it.
You bugged me. No, it came up literally in conversation, like, how, you know, what do you talk to your mates about? Oh, what are you up to at the moment? And he at the time was not, I didn't see him regularly. He was living up in Birmingham. And it came a conversation. And I think how it worked is he was actively recruiting people to come and sign up to his deals, for lack of a better phrase. So he actively recruited me and then said...
Recruited to work with you or to work
for him? Initially, he got me to take out some phone contracts that he could then use to make money out of. And I made some money from. At that stage, I didn't know anything was illegal. I thought it was this sort of loophole. I didn't really know what was going on. I didn't ask too many questions. I made like 100 quid out of doing that. It was, again, just like, just do this. You're just taking out a phone contract. You give me the handset and the SIM card. You don't need to know anything about it. We pay your bills. It's all good. Made 100 quid from that. And then he later approached me and basically then said, do you want to come and work for me and do like the admin? So at this point, his like organization had grown and I was... there to do like some of the admin. At this stage, I then realized, and was then fully clued in on the fact that it was illegal. And, Yeah, so I then left my job. I'd been sort of helping out a little bit part-time, and then I left my job to go full-time work for
Why?
Him. Good question. You reflect back. I don't think you can't give a clear cut. Yes. No. I think part of it comes down to I was very bored. I didn't like my job. I didn't see myself going anywhere in it. And you know, when I say cushy sales job, I was on 26 grand a year.
Was it better money?
He was going to match my money. The lifestyle was going to be better in that I was going to spend all my time with my mates. It looked like a chilled lifestyle. If I'm honest, it probably looked quite like exhilarating. You know, I was committing a crime. And that sounds fucking ridiculous. When I look back now, that's like embarrassing. But probably that would form part of it. And I definitely don't want this.
So you knew right from, you quit your job knowing you were embarking on something illegal.
Yeah. That came later, a little bit later, knowing that it was fully illegal. But I think at the point I left to do it, I was fairly sure that
the
bedrock of what we were doing was not legal. But
Rob, looking back, do you think that your mate who approached you kind of manipulated you because he knew you would do it?
Good question. Probably part of it, but I think, I was smart enough. I was,
Because in my head, if I'm thinking he's used you to get phones out, and then obviously he's asked you to come on board, that kind of means that he kind of knows that he's kind of got you in his pocket.
I didn't feel like at that time, and I don't look back now and go, I think some people have spoken to me going, he was using you and he did that. And I think there's probably an element of that, but like, I also went in there sort of with my eyes open, so I made that decision, so I'm accountable. And then I think the other part of it, when I look back, and this is, I definitely don't want this to come across as being, I say, this was the reason why, but look, I had some personal stuff going on, my dad was really ill at the time. And I think when I look back, cause it just makes no sense, it's not like I was doubling my money or anything, I'm matching my money. So you sort of look back and go, what on earth was I thinking? But, I think probably the wider picture of my personal set circumstances probably gave me a bit of a kind of like devil may care attitude. Like I was probably a bit like, fuck this, I'll go and do that. And you don't care. It makes you a bit selfish. Oh, that'll be nicer for me. Or, it probably sets that slightly. So I think that definitely contributed to it. It's sort of how I can sort of kind of make sense of it because on paper, it makes absolutely no, I wasn't making the kind of money that the guys that were running the business were. But I was taking on.
Were there promises of making more money?
No, I mean, there was an opportunity. It was like a commission-based game. Like the more people you introduced to the scheme, for lack of a better phrase, the more money you made. So guys at the top of that tree were making big, big money. So, at the height of it, guys were making, talking like tens, if not hundreds of thousands of pounds a week. So there was big, big money knocking around. So I think that's part of the allure of it. I wasn't very happy. I was going into an environment where I hated like working in the corporate environment. So I was suddenly going somewhere that was really chilled. We were going out two or three times a week, all the stuff that goes with that. You're, partying, doing all that kind of stuff. So it was probably more like a lifestyle kind of thing. But even looking back on that, it's not the best decision I've made.
It's definitely not the best decision you've made. So apart from the day-to-day legal activity that you know that you're engaged in, it's got repercussions that, there are wider impacts. What did your friends and family think was happening? Did they know? Did you start to lie to people?
Yeah, I mean, I lied to people from the off. I mean, I never told anyone I'm committing fraud. I think there was the initial kind of like cover story. I mean, without going into too much detail, it was sort of quite complicated. It's within like the back end of like how mobile phone networks work, which is a grey area generally. And I think it was a sort of far enough off that people wouldn't know the ins and outs that there was a fairly convincing cover story that was generated that made it seem that we'd found like a legal loophole as opposed to we were out and out ripping these guys off, which was the story that I spun to my friends and family.
Did you like proper know you was like ripping people off?
Yeah.
Okay.
So
did you start to believe it yourself?
No.
No.
I think some people did. I never did.
Right.
And I think I never quite, I think, deep down, I think there was part of me that never quite settled on that because I didn't like it. But I kept going, the reality is I kept
and
going.
And why, sorry, I'm jumping about a bit, but you're lying to your friends and family because you don't want to tell them. Why didn't you want to tell them? What didn't you want to tell them?
Because I think within my I don't think they'd have accepted it. I mean, you know, I think if I'd have turned around to my dad or to my brother that I was out and out committing a crime, I think, you know, they would have gone nuts. You know, they would have, you know.
So you didn't tell people because you knew it was wrong?
Yeah.
And wrong morally amongst your peers rather than just being illegal? You thought there'd be a moral judgment against it?
No, I think it was probably more the criminal aspect. I think, you know, if I told my friends and family that I was full-time committing a crime for a job, I think the point that when you're asking why, like, I think you just go, it seemed obvious to me not to tell anyone.
Right.
You know, I had to tell them that I was doing something legit because otherwise they'd talk you out of it or they'd, you know, you'd risk people then, you know, going to the police or, you know, that kind of thing. That's the kind of thing. It was kept really in-house. So when we got nicked, I think there were 35 people arrested, of which 8 knew that we were doing anything illegal. So it was kept really small circle.
You were lying amongst your own colleagues.
Yeah. And so you didn't tell anyone else because it was kept that quiet, because you don't want that getting out. You can't have that known. And also the whole scheme was predicated on it not being illegal. So the fact you did not want that getting out, that it was illegal, because then people wouldn't sign up and the whole thing would collapse from there. So it was all, the whole thing was built on it being legit. So within the very inner circle, we discussed the illegalities of it. But outwardly, there was this sort of cover story that was spun to make, to keep the whole thing going.
Yeah. And when you say, do you discussed the when you say that you discussed that it wasn't legal, were you discussing that in a way of like fear of getting caught or what? In what way were you discussing that it was
more
legal?
Yes. So it was more, from my side, it was me asking the guys or the guy at the top for some kind of reassurance that he was explaining that we weren't going to get caught, because I was not dealing directly with certain parties. So I played I was an administrator, for lack of a better phrase. So I was dealing with one very small part of it, but that part was integral to the illegal side of essentially getting contracts closed off where we'd stolen the handsets. So I was playing one small role. So I was quite regularly trying to seek reassurance that we weren't going to get caught.
Right.
And so that was all coming down from the guys at the top. And then, look, the reality was we used to joke about it. I mean, it sounds ridiculous. And when you look back now, it's mad. But, you know, for example, one of the guys, we used to work out of their house in Fulham. And at one point, you know, one of those flyers came round and it was like a police one that said fraud comes in all shapes and sizes. And like one of these ones was like different people in the lineup. And like, I remember like joking about that, like with the guy that I was founding. And, you know, when you look back, you're like, that is stupid. But that was how there was a real kind of like relaxed atmosphere to it. It wasn't like we were constantly like sweating and looking over our shoulders going, we're going to get caught. We were fairly young and stupid. And we thought there was a lot of like, we're probably not going to get caught. You believe what you want to believe in that scenario. Mm. There's money coming in, the life does good. You want to believe that that's going to continue.
So you were aware that if you got caught, you would be arrested and convicted of, or the potential. To what end? Did you think that could be as far as prison, or you didn't allow yourself to go there?
Didn't think that far ahead. You just thought, you knew there'd be consequences if you were caught, but I had not had the specific thought, if I get caught, I'll go to prison.
Why did you think that you weren't going to get caught? Was it because you thought you were invincible as a group of white middle-class lads? Or
you must have felt secure, like, within your group that you were doing.
I didn't think it directly like that. I know what you're getting at, and I think, you know, maybe people outwardly looking in would go, that's what you were thinking. I never thought that, but I think in a roundabout way, possibly, because I think I just didn't know anyone that had been to prison. That never crossed your mind. I'd never, you know, that just never would never enter your thoughts, because I didn't have that as a, oh, I know John who did this, or Dave. We can't say John, because John's the guy who's in it. Poor choice of that. Yeah.
Okay, delete.
John
delete.
Is in prison, he's still in it.
John ain't going anywhere.
No, I think in a roundabout way, you probably did, but sort of more subconsciously, just because I'd never experienced anyone going, but I didn't know anyone in my social circle that had. So you just sort of taking this kind of blind risk without thinking of the consequences. I think it's probably more a case of not thinking. But then I guess for someone else looking in, and when you reflect on that, I guess that probably is down to like people like us don't go to prison because I didn't know anyone that had been to prison.
Yeah.
So yeah, I can sort of see that, but it wasn't like it wasn't that kind of arrogant of people like us don't go to prison. Like, you know, I think probably deep down I knew that there were serious consequences, but I also remember one of my first meetings with my lawyers when I went there, and I said, out of interest, if I'm found guilty, what would be the you know, the punishment? I was, you know, a bit taken aback, because I think probably in my head at that point I was thinking slap on the wrist, fine.
You know, we were
still, there were still people chatting about it's a civil offence, it's a breach of contract, it's not criminal. So I'm thinking, and I'm not playing a leading role in this, I'm playing like a pretty minor role within this. So I'm thinking, I'll get a bollocking from my dad, we'll get a slap on the wrist and a fine. And then they're like, yeah, if you found guilty, you'll do 3 to 6 years in prison. No questions asked. And I was like, oh, okay. So like that was, I remember that very clearly being a bit of a, you know, yeah, real hammer to the chest, thinking, shit, okay, this is a lot more serious than I thought.
And what did, I guess one thing we could talk about is how it all came to a head, but just leading from what you just said, what was it like to have to break to your friends and family to acknowledge that you had been involved in something that presumably they didn't think that someone they knew would be getting involved in something like that?
Do you know, that didn't actually bother me that much. Look back, it wasn't like this big kind of shameful moment. I, you know, found my brother. I don't think any of them were particularly surprised. I mean, to those that had been, you know, outwardly they'd see a group of young lads who were doing something. They didn't quite know what was going on, but it didn't sound 100% street legal. And then suddenly, you know, these guys are driving around, you know, the house in Fulham we were working out of had a white Lamborghini parked outside of it. And, you know, guys driving around in Bentleys and Ranges, you know, so, I mean, we didn't exactly fly under the radar. And, you know,
you weren't subtle. You
weren't subtle. So I don't think, yeah, I don't think anyone was particularly shocked in that sense. But I think, yeah, I think it was not the most fun phone call I've had to when I had to ring my dad and tell him that I'd been arrested. And
so how did it all come to a...
So we were working out of a serviced offices just over Putney Bridge. So really nice surroundings. It's sort of this big complex of like five offices. And at like 9:30 in the morning, literally the door got booted in and it was like 20 police officers like full on like that kind of riot gear, like, you know, like blue fatigues with army boots and stuff on. And if you think I'm busy, mate, these keynotes who thought they were fucking getting Saddam Hussein out, you know, like, I mean, we were like, weren't allowed to talk or move. We had to get escorted to the toilet. And then, so this was in August. So this big service office is probably like, I don't know, 2,000 people working in this thing. And there's a nice green in the middle. And everyone, there was probably 300 people out on the green having their lunch. And we got frog marched out, cuffed behind our backs into the paddy wagons. I mean, that was the lowest point. I mean, you're just thinking, fucking hell.
Is anyone
deal me out? Is there a back door we can go out? So they take you out in front of us. And obviously, like, people are like talking and... Yeah, so we were held there for like 9 hours in the office, or 6 hours in the offices, and we got taken to Charing Cross Police Station up in town. And the ridiculous thing at this point was there were cash flow issues within the business, but because I'm mates with the guy doing it, I was on like a promise to pay thing. So like we had no money and I had like 23p in my bank account and I was just getting sorted out with cash. Like I need the rent paid. So he'd find me like 600 quid from somewhere to put so I could pay my rent. And he'd give me a tenner for my lunch and stuff. And it was all like trust-based. I was like, I know that when the cash comes good, you'll sort me out. So it's fine. But so running this ridiculous operation, but I've got 26p to my name when I get nicked. So I'm walking over. I lived in Putney at the time. So I'm walking over Putney Bridge, 10-minute walk to work. And then my plan to get home is to walk back over Putney Bridge. But suddenly I'm released from my first, I got interviewed and released at 2:30 in the morning up in just off Fleet Street in the pissing rain. And I went getting booked out and I was like, well, how am I going to get home? And he goes, where do you live? I was like, I've got no money. Like, how do I get home? He goes, where do you live? I went, Putney. He goes, I've walked further than that. And just booted me out. Yeah. Well, and I mean, that was the lowest point. Yeah. I was like, fuck me. And then, yeah, so we got released, but then I wasn't allowed to contact. They kept my phone. So I had no phone. I had no money. Got booked out. So, but the thing is, I had no phone. And the only phone number I knew off by heart was my dad's. And I'm like, well, I'm not fucking ringing him. Because part of it, he wasn't well at the time. So he was like, he's not getting a phone call going, dad. So I went home and I lived off, for 3 days, I lived off a banana and one pack of Minstrels, because that's all the food I had. And I had nowhere contacting anyone else. So eventually I managed to go and track down my brother. And I remember he lived in Wandsworth, so he was about like 20 minutes away from me. So I went over, camped outside his house, because I was like, I've got to get some food. And I was like, I'm not allowed to contact any of my immediate friendship group. So I've gone to camp outside there. And I eventually tracked him down to a pub. And I remember very clearly getting him. And he thought I'd just bumped into him in the pub. He doesn't know I've been stalking him for like half a day. Bear Grylls tracked him down. And then I literally just broke down in floods of tears in the middle of the road when he's there. And I think that was like the stress of like, been nicked, all it sort of came to, and fair play, he was good as gold. He would have been well within his rights to go, you're a fucking idiot, but he didn't. You know, he gave me 500 quid, go sort yourself out, gave me a good meal, all that kind of stuff. So to come back to your question, yeah, it was probably, there was a bit of an embarrassment about telling my family and stuff, but you know what, coming through this, they were all unbelievable to me. You know, at points, yeah, there was a bit of, what were you doing? But I never got that big bollocking, and I think you know, everyone was really understanding.
The police
but that was,
gave I mean, that to you.
Yeah. But I think, yeah, that kind of stuff was yeah, quite kind of like quite traumatic. But, you know, you bring it on yourself. I'm not asking for any sympathy or stuff. But then, you know, so that was sort of, once we then got nicked, and then you're then trying to process that and you've got to go see lawyers.
Do you think you were relieved in any way that it was over?
Probably, yeah. I think so.
That you were just like walking on,
I think you
on eggshells until a point of.
I think so, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I've seen enough, you know, documentaries on, you know, what I'd call proper criminals, like serious criminals and stuff, that people have been on the run. And we were inside in Rochester with a couple of guys that were, you know, like been on the run for 8, 9, 10 years. And they talk about the relief of getting caught, you know. And I think there was an element of that, because there was, underneath it all, you were sort of secretly, you know, day to day going to work thinking, what if we get caught?
Right. Do you think everyone was? That was
not. I mean, there was not immediate relief, to be clear. The immediate feeling was, fuck, this isn't great.
It got worse before it got better.
But I think, yeah, afterwards, I think you probably look back and you go, yeah, there's probably an element of that.
But Rob, you see, after hearing like your story, the thing I don't really understand, even like trying to relate it to mine, is like, you don't seem like you was money motivated. So it seems like, were you just doing it just to be around the camaraderie of your boys and
back? I think that was it. I think that was part of it.
Yeah.
Like I said, I think it was the lifestyle thing. And look, I'm really wary of not saying this is why, because my brother went through exactly the same experience.
Yeah,
he's never committed a crime in his life. But I think the circumstances of my dad was dying, essentially, you know, I think that changes your perception on things.
Of course.
And I think it makes you act rashly. And I think, you know, it contributed to making, obviously, some of the worst decisions I've ever made. So I think that's it. Look, and you're not the first person to ask that. I mean, other people were there. Because I was not in the same boat as some of these guys that were... I was not driving a Lamborghini. I was not, you know, in a, you know, 10 grand a month house renting and that kind of stuff. I was living a lifestyle of someone that was on 24, 26 grand a year.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think, you know... And then, look, I think you then have to look deeper than that. Like, it's not just because of my circumstances and my dad. I think, you know, I think I was probably that... kind of like the camaraderie, wanting to be in that, you know, my desire to break away from corporate world, which I was really bored with, and this seemed like thrilling and exhilarating, which I think comes from, you know, I think maybe from your background, that's more like a reality. Yeah. And I think this, when I look back, and it's almost embarrassing looking at it, you know, it's like the thrill of it, and it's like, oh yeah, go and commit crime.
Because even looking at you thinking, like, obviously your background, you've gone to boarding school and stuff, I don't look at you and think, oh, what are you doing committing crimes? Because I know all different types of people commit crimes, so I don't think of it like that. But I'm just still trying to understand, like, surely it wasn't just being around your boys that made you want to get involved.
I think, look, I'm still trying to piece it together. The answer I've given you is the best conclusion I've come through myself. Like, I can't transport back into 25, 26-year-old me. And I sort of go, look, it has to be a bit of greed because I thought there was an opportunity to make money there. It was lifestyle because I was going out and, you know, a lot of that's driven by, you know, we're partying and taking a load of drugs and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I couldn't do that working my job, but I could get away with that there. So that's definitely an element of it. So you sort of piece a bit of that together, maybe of everything, and then just maybe a bit of like, oh, that's a fucking idiot.
Naivety.
Like just a bit stupid.
Naivety.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that kind of, I'd probably, you know, I'd been through some stuff in my life, but I'd not seen anyone affected by that. I'd not seen anyone go to prison. I'd never seen anyone suffer the consequences of committing a crime other than on TV.
On a smaller level, had you ever suffered the consequences of doing anything wrong, not even illegal.
That's like minor stuff at school. Like I've gotten in trouble for being stupid and stuff at school, but not like nothing serious. I mean, like I said, I'd taken knocks in my life. Like I'd see, you know, I'd been through some bits, but not as a result of my actions. Do you know what I mean? So I think, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, no, I don't. Yeah, no, I'd never. I don't think I can't think of anything off the top of my head.
But even looking back now, do you even think what you did was that bad?
Do you know what? I don't lose sleep about defrauding the mobile networks, which is what we were convicted of. What does bother me, and what I do really regret, is I think, so how it worked was you would pay people to take out contracts on our behalf, and we'd use those, and often those were like students or people that didn't have much money, and some of those, you know, were affected as a result. You know, when the business went down, we couldn't pay their phone bills, which were still active in their names, and so some of these people then weren't able to pay it themselves, and so the credit ratings were affected. People getting chased for shitloads of cash, that's really stressful. And, you know, these are guys that are not, you know, like hardened criminals. These are like completely innocent. They're students, they're people, you know, who are maybe not have money. And that puts a lot of stress on people. So that's the bit when I look back, I was just really selfish. Time, I didn't consider that at the
victims,
time.
They were victims, individual
victims. They were the victims. Like, look, I said, you know, the reality is, no, I do not feel guilty about defrauding EE. But, you know, when you look at actually the collateral damage on that was these guys that really did suffer and had their lives affected. Yeah, I feel...
Even though you weren't the one grafting to get them.
No, and I didn't... And I did it on the understanding that I didn't think anyone would be affected like that. Yeah, it was like an unexpected consequence in a way. But actually, when you look back, like, it's because I didn't give it enough thought.
Yeah.
And I think that's the selfishness. I was just thinking about me, like, how can I make money? How can I better my circumstances, and I didn't give enough thought to that, because it wouldn't have taken a lot to think, hang on, well, what happens if this goes tits up? These guys are going to get stuck with contracts.
Sometimes you don't think like that,
no, but I think that's it. But that's the you know, I think when you look back on it, you go, that it was selfishness. I think, you know, that at that time in my life I was very selfish, and that sort of probably triggers a lot of that thought behavior, because all you're thinking about is, how can I make my life better? I think that's probably part of it.
When I got nicked, it took me about 7 months. I was on bail for 7 months. Then obviously I had to go to trial, and then I obviously was found guilty and went to jail. How long did it take you once you were nicked? What was the process for you?
From the day they kicked our door in to when I got sentenced was nearly 2.5 years.
How long did it take you to get charged?
I think over a year. I think over a year before I got charged. So I was on, we just kept getting rebailed and rebailed, because it's what they call like a paper heavy case. Yeah. So all this stuff is, like I say, it was like outwardly seen as a bit of a grey area. So they were firstly trying to establish if what we were doing was criminal. It's like, so it took them a long time to unpick that. And so this whole time, I didn't really know what was going on. And then eventually I got charged. But in that time, like I said, there were like 35 people that were originally arrested. And so at different stages of that, different people are getting NFA. Yeah. So they're getting no further action.
Did you think you could have got off with it?
Well, I was sort of, I thought I was probably in the next tranche of people getting released. Yeah. I was wrong. And then they sort of got through, and I was sort of right on that cusp, and that, you know, obviously then they decided to charge me. And I think at that point I knew I was in pretty serious trouble. That was like, up and down. And then also, I mean, we had other stuff going on with that. I mean, it's interesting, like when you were talking about your case, you were saying about one of your co-defendants, you know, essentially his defence was that you'd stitched him up. And I think we had a bit of that. You know, there were guys involved in that that decided to cooperate with the police. You know, these are guys that knew full well what were going on. And you know, I think, you know, I was interviewed on three separate occasions by the police. I commented everything. And at the end of that, they do, you know, I'm told this is very standard practice, that the tape gets stopped and they go, look, mate, we know you're not that serious. If you just let us know what was going up at the top, this all goes away. And I think that is pretty, you know, talking to my law and stuff, they're like, that's pretty standard practice. And I think, you know, it's like what you said. I think that kind of, I'd made my bed and I was going to lie in it. As far as my mind was decided, look, I knew going into it, I went in with my eyes sort of open, and I decided, look, I've fucked this up. I'm not going to, you know, I don't think I could live myself if I, you know, cut the legs out of the guys above me just to make sure I didn't, you know, suffer the consequences. I think that was one of the difficult bits, because, you know, a lot of this stuff was built around a friendship group. So it wasn't just random lads that you're working with. It's people that you know and some people you've grown up with. So that, you know, that's a difficult dynamic from there, that you know that some people have made one decision and you made another. And I try not to be too judgmental about it, but then also, you know, they're not on my Christmas card list, I think, with that stuff. You know? Yeah. But it makes it difficult. It's a, you know, and it's an interesting one about, look, I made a decision one way and other people do it another way. And look, there was one guy within our trial who, you know, openly he turned Crown witness, and he essentially, you know, gave them chapter and verse on what was going on, and as a result did not go to prison. And that's, you know, that's something I don't agree with, you know, in that sense, you know, because he's someone that fully knew what was going on when the good times were rolling. And then to do that, I think that's, that's like a difficult thing to kind of wrap your head around, I think. But I think it's also something I walk away from going like, I'm glad I did it.
Yeah.
It's like what you said as well. I wouldn't change it. You could give me that option 10 times again. I'd do the same 10 times, because I think as much as some people and my friends and family would not agree with me, you know, I don't think I could live with myself on that in terms of like, I'd find that harder to square with.
Yeah.
I'd save my own arse and done that. So I think, you know, but, and that's like an interesting to look at, like some people listening to this, some people looking at that might disagree. But
it's mad because people would say obviously doing the crime is immoral, but what you've obviously shown that you do have morals as well. But obviously some would say that's being silly, but to me I'd think that's the same thing. I think that's being quite moral.
Well, I think that's it. I think it's it makes like an interesting kind of dynamic in terms of like where you draw the line on what's acceptable, what's done, what isn't. But going back to, I think, you know, that was that sort of nearly 2.5 years was without question harder than the 9 months I did inside. You know, the uncertainty about what's going to happen. And actually, you asked me about, did I feel relief when we got nicked? Short answer, probably not. Definitely not at the time.
But relief when you got charged.
When I did feel relief was when I changed my plea. So I never went to trial, and I was going not guilty, not guilty, not guilty. And I was having to go repeatedly to these lawyers' meetings where essentially you're lying, because I'm trying to say I never knew anything. And you're like trying to sort of skirt around the fact that like there's a decent bit of evidence that points to the fact I did know that something dodgy was going on. So it's a really odd dynamic that. So I'm sort of lying to my own legal team. And I'm staring down the barrel of going to court. And I remember clearly I went to a meeting with my barrister who, sort of without telling me, decided this meeting he was going to do essentially a dry run. He'd at this point now had a chance to fully acquaint himself with my case and all the evidence against me. And he went for me in this meeting. I was sat there on my own. I think I was a little bit hungover. And I'm in this meeting and he went for me as if he was a prosecution barrister. And that was stressful in a room on my own, just my lawyer and my barrister. And then you're like, shit, am I going to have to do this in a court with like a jury and my family watching and stuff? And I think sort of at that point there was like a kind of, we need to assess what our approach is to this.
Yeah.
I'm not going to go into details, but circumstances of our conspiracy, because there were 8 of us charged, changed so that one person within the group changed their plea. And that had a knock-on effect that essentially it completely undermined my defence. So I wasn't going to be able to form a defence. So then it became a bit of a no-brainer, basically. There was a rather swiftly arranged conference call with my legal team, and they basically said, we either create a new defence for you in the next 5 weeks or you change your plea. So then I changed my plea, and then you have this sort of funny day where you go to court. I was actually papped outside the courtroom, which was an odd experience, and then you get there. And all these Jobsworth police officers are on the case. And it sounds odd saying that, but they were. I mean, they turned up just to see me do a 5-minute plea hearing. Really smug. And I guess, look, fair, in some sense, it's fair enough.
It's their like, job.
I'm a criminal. That is their job.
Yeah.
My view at the time was, what a bunch of Jobsworth. So I was determined not to let them see that I was like upset about this. So you go, you change your plea. And I do remember walking out of there. I'm immensely relieved.
Mm.
That was my overriding emotion, was thank fuck this like 2.5 year hell is over. And now at least I know what I'm doing.
Like,
I know I'm going to prison. And obviously that's daunting, but I was much happier dealing with that than the uncertainty of, and the prospect of like a 2-week trial where I was going to be in the dock and I was going to be getting ripped to absolute shreds in front of everyone. So that was the point where the relief came, and then that swiftly fizzled out and I went fucking hell, I'm off to prison.
And what about now? So you've got rules that you can't, you know, become a director of a company. But what, you know, what?
I can't own or operate a firearm for the next 3 years either.
That's a relief.
That's my shooting career out the window. Yeah. Livid.
What's your view on getting involved? Or like, do you think this is the last of it?
Yeah, for me, I think, you know, it's, I don't think it ever really occurred to me that I was then going to pursue a life of crime. And I think that actually, I think quite interestingly shaped my time inside, because I think a lot of the guys in there you know, Boats, you'll know this. There's a lot of guys in there that go in there giving it the big I am, you know, and they're like, and they like see it as like a networking opportunity. It's like, you know, it's like a big networking event being in prison. And they're trying to, yeah, I'm going to make moves when I get out. And look, for some people, look, I say that people give it the big I am. There's also people in there for, they are career criminals. I mean, that's just a choice they've made. They're going to do it. But I think the fact that I wasn't, and I was so obviously not keen on like getting involved in any of that kind of stuff, I think people then weren't threatened by me because they, you know, so I think, you know, I was able to kind of like, and I was quite, you know, I wasn't even pretending that, you know, I was quite open about, look, I just did something pretty stupid and here I am. And I think that, you know, I think that probably shaped partly my time in there in terms of the relationships I made with people.
I mean, during that really long period of time between being first arrested and coming to a conclusion, that 2.5 years, I mean, you've got to get on with day-to-day life. That's a very, it's a long period of limbo land that you're in. You've got to earn a living. You've got to pay your rent. What did you get up to during that time?
Yeah, I guess you try and return to kind of like business as usual as much as possible. I actually, one of my good mates who'd had nothing to do with what we were doing with the fraud, he stepped in and he had a family business and he offered me some work there. Like initially, literally in the immediate aftermath, in their warehouse, helping out, like a bit of cash in hand stuff, just to sort of literally immediately get me back on my feet so I could pay that month's rent and put food on my table. And then, you know, he then actually offered me like a longer term thing. So I ended up working for him for sort of, I think, a year to 18 months. And that was like kind of a trend of, actually my friendship group were really, really supportive, and my wider network were really supportive. I think, you know, there was an acknowledgement that I'd obviously done something stupid, but I don't think anyone saw me as like a bad person, maybe, to put it. Like, I think they probably recognised that I'd just done something really stupid.
And do you think that was the nature of the crime? So do you think your friends would have had a different reaction if you had been involved in, you know, some serious violence, for example?
Probably, yeah. I think that was it. I think, look, and people even openly said it to me that they probably saw it as a bit of a victimless crime. And I think I touched on earlier the fact that I felt probably a little bit guilty about the individuals that were impacted by what it did, you know, like the students and things that signed up. And I think people didn't really know about that at the time. They just thought that we were ripping off these big blue chip mobile phone providers, and they probably recognised that. So I think you're right. Yeah, I think if it was for assault or for, you know, something like that, I think the reaction quite possibly would have been different. I think also as well, probably what impacted the reaction was my dad died in that time between me being nicked and going to prison. So I think also the context of that, I think people thought, look, what I'd done was stupid. But I think they probably reserved a bit of judgment and just were probably more supportive trying to get me through a bit of a difficult time. And I think in the context of, because my mum had died when I was 13, so my dad died, you know, doing that, I think that was a really, really difficult time for me. So I think people were probably, they probably felt they didn't want to kick me while I was down a bit with that. So yeah. I think, you know, I'm sure that shaped it. But yeah, I'm across the board, everyone was, you know, really supportive of me that. And I'm really grateful for that. When you look back, you sort of go, because not everyone's that lucky, do you know what I mean? Like, I think, you know, to have a group of people that's kind of rallied around me a bit and tried to sort of get me through it meant that I was probably not in the worst place when I did go to prison. You know, I was sort of...
And what about people you didn't know? So you talk about, you know, getting with business as usual, but that's a big weight on your shoulders. I mean, what about, you know, did you... I don't know if you had a relationship at the time, or if you're out dating, do you drop that in, or...
It's difficult.
You know, is there kind of, you can't quite commit to future plans?
No, I was single at the time. And so I think, it becomes a bit tricky though when you're on dates and stuff. You sort of, you're a little bit like that uncertainty, I'm sure, plays a part. And then it's awkward. Like, when do you mention, like, oh, I'm like on bail or whatever, or, you know, like there's this thing going on that you sort of probably have to mention. And I probably didn't get that right all the time, and it makes it difficult. And then I think, look, also the reality is some people quite like that. Like, you know, you're a middle class society.
Rob,
like,
the people bad
like,
boy. Well,
exactly. Like, little did they know I'd been like the admin guy working through spreadsheets. I wasn't exactly Al Capone. So it's a funny dynamic. You get a bit of everything there. You get, you know, I can't think of a time actually where anyone outwardly was like, you're a bit of a prick. They probably thought it.
Mm.
It was definitely, it's an odd time looking back. It's, you know, difficult one to manage. It's all a bit like,
yeah, can you see?
There's not a textbook on how to deal with that situation, no. I don't think.
Can you see a set of circumstances arising in the future that you could get embroiled in something?
No. No, I think, you know, I think my time with that kind of stuff is done. I think, you know, when I look back on the you know, how that affected me and how it affected my friends and family, I think, you know, I think a big part of my certainty in saying no is, I think I was very lucky to have my friends and family were very supportive of me. I think that would be a different story if I got caught
doing
something
again. They'd lose their, yeah, I think that patience. Would
be, yeah, exactly. So I think you sort of, that plays a big part in my unwillingness to get involved in anything serious like that again. And you sort of hope that hope that you're making better decisions these days.
Learn a lesson, as they say.
Yeah, I think so.
I'm looking at what you did and I don't actually think you've done, obviously it's a crime, but I don't like what you said, people weren't judging you as harshly because he didn't do something violent. And I'm looking at it as well, thinking, yeah, you made a mistake, but it's not the end of the world. Like, you didn't hurt anyone. And a lot of people do look at crimes like that.
I think that's a bit of a problem, though. I think this hierarchy of crimes amongst people that commit crimes is as to sort of justify some of your own actions. And
obviously, crime's crime, but hearing the story, obviously, he told me it briefly in jail, and I'm just thinking... Yeah,
but what makes me laugh is you say that, you know, I had this same conversation when I moved back to London, when I came off tag with my probation officer.
Yeah.
She came in with, well, I've looked at it. I don't really see what you guys did much wrong.
No,
and she was like, who out there can't say they haven't done something dodgy at the time? I was like, well, for starters, my probation officer would have thought I could say that.
No, it's true.
Not to me, yeah.
But you'd be amazed at how many people take that view. Yeah. And I was in this bizarre situation where I'm sat in a room with my probation officer and they're telling me they can't really see that I've done that much wrong.
And maybe, you know, maybe,
tell that
maybe,
to the judge.
Maybe I'm looking at it because of maybe my background and like, if that was done with someone I know, I would think, you know, it's nothing. But I don't really look at it as a bad crime. Obviously, the law is the law and you have to abide by it.
But
go to jail for that is a bit mad.
Well, I think that's something that we should talk about and we want to talk about because there's a big difference between sort of saying whether something is right or wrong and that, you know, that's not our choice.
It's technically a crime,
but as to how we deal with that and is prison the place to be is a different question. I think that we might talk about it a bit next week. Can we talk about
next week? We're going to solve the justice system. So
yeah.
Tune in for that.
Thanks Rob for being very honest and open.
Thank you.
Hi guys, it's Rob here. Thanks very much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. Just to give you a quick reminder that if you haven't already, to subscribe to make sure you get the new episodes as they come out every Monday and leave us a review with any of your feedback wherever you listen to the pod. You can also get us on our Twitter and Instagram accounts, which are at Banged Up Podcast. You can send us any questions you want for our weekly Q&A and also catch some other bits and pieces like excerpts from my diary. Okay, thanks very much. Catch you soon.